We're here with Kathleen Carr, and I can't tell you how wonderful it's been to spend some time with you and how lovely your hospitality has been and your generosity and your time, and I want to thank you for taking this time today. So tell us a little bit about yourself, about your background. You're originally from Los Angeles.
I was born in L.A., and then when my parents moved to the East Coast, I was five. So I grew to 5 to 12 on the East Coast, and then they moved back to California, Southern California. So I kind of grew up both coasts, bicoastal, I guess you'd call it. Then went to university at UCSB Santa Barbara.
And that, you studied photography there?
Well, actually, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and so I ended up changing my major every year. So I ended up in art, and then I finally took a fine art photography course, and there was only one course, and I took it, and I realized that was in my senior year, and I realized that's what I wanted to do.
Yes.
So then I actually took off for a couple years from school and then went back and got a degree, a BFA in photography from Ohio University.
Yes. And what were your favorite things to take? Had you sort of been an amateur photographer before you studied it, or was that sort of the dawn of your photographic
journey? I was interested, but more just snapshots. I took, my father had a camera that he gave to me, so I took a lot of snapshots and a lot of 8mm and Super 8 home movies and ski trips and stuff like that. But in terms of fine art or, you know, kind of really communicating on a deeper level, I got awakened to that when I took this one photography class.
Now, may I ask, what was the first serious camera that you owned? What kind was it? And then I'll tell you what mine was.
Well, my father gave me a Kodak Retina Reflex.
Okay.
So I had that.
Was that an SLR?
Yes. And then I bought a Nikon mat from Japan.
Okay.
With a Nikon.
Did it clean your clothes? It sounds like a laundry mat.
No. That was my main camera, film camera for many, many years, and then I just kept upgrading the Nikon cameras.
Yes. Did you shoot both print film and slide film?
Yes. I did black and white, a lot of black and white that I printed. I had a dark room. I printed those images myself, and then mostly 35mm slides because that's what, for publication.
Yes.
They wanted.
So, you know, did you use Kodachrome 25?
Oh, yeah.
That's like a landmark film for its colors and stuff like that. And then I used that a lot, but I used Kodachrome 25 and 64, and then Ektachrome 160 became one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, I kind of, after Kodachrome, I switched to Fujichrome.
Really?
Or Velvia.
Yes.
For the nice bright colors.
I think a lot of photographers think that has better colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, when did you first take any infrared photos?
Let's see, I wanted to say something about after I got my degree in photography, I had the great fortune to study at a live-in workshop with Minor White for about 5 months.
Now tell us who that is.
And he was one of the kind of big gun black and white photographers like Ansel Adams and,
really? Elliot,
and Weston.
Okay.
And he was on the East Coast, and he taught at MIT, and it was kind of the first time I got in touch with the idea of photography as a vehicle for spiritual growth.
Yes, and so did you learn both sort of philosophical and spiritual stuff as well as technical stuff?
Exactly, and so then that, when I got to Findhorn a couple years later, and I was one of the photographers at Findhorn for 7 years. That definitely informed how I approached photographing everything, whether
yes.
it was a person or a landscape or a flower or a plant.
Yes. Now, with Minor, did you go out, did he take you on, like, photographic journeys or expeditions and
Not
stuff like
so
that?
Not so much. He would... we were living in his house, so it was kind of very much immersion experience.
Okay.
And so he'd written a a book, which actually never ended up getting published, but I have one of the original typewritten manuscripts. Mm-hmm. And so that was our kind of textbook, and it had exercises in perception and expanding your awareness. And so we would have assignments, and we would go out and photograph. And we had to use 4x5 view cameras for this.
Yes. Well, now you mentioned Findhorn. Before you tell us about how you found out about it and got to go there, tell, for people that aren't familiar, tell us exactly what it is and you know, in a nutshell, what it was and how it started and what it might be now.
Oh, okay. So Findhorn was started unintentionally in 1962. Basically, Peter and Eileen Caddy, their three children and their friend Dorothy McLean, had been managing pretty high-end hotels and bringing them up to five-star category.
In Northern Scotland.
And one of them was this hotel, Clunny Hill Hotel, which is right near where they ended up, next to Findhorn. And so they got sent to another hotel to do the same thing, and it didn't work out. They got fired, basically. And the only place they had to go was their little tiny trailer that was, and they took it to the Findhorn Bay Caravan Park. And so Peter kept trying to get jobs, and he was fit. He was a RAF officer, retired, and he had, you know, a lot of skills. But for some reason, the jobs kept falling through, and so they were living on unemployment, basically. So they started a garden to supplement so they could eat.
Yes, and the place was already called Findhorn Bay.
Yes, it's in Findhorn. So, but what it is, it's a sandy, windswept peninsula.
Yes.
It's all sand dunes. So there was no soil to grow this garden. So they'd go around collecting horse poop and seaweed and food scraps and grasses and stuff and make compost to put on top of this sand. They were all meditators, and they were, you know, had been in this spiritual group. And so they would meditate twice a day. And Dorothy started getting this feeling that she was supposed to touch in with the nature kingdom. And so she loved nature, so she thought she would start with garden pea, because that was her favorite vegetable. So she kind of tuned into the garden pea and got this amazing message of who we are as humanity and our place in the universe. And then it's like, well, you know, the tomatoes need some liquid manure, and, you know, very specific information about the garden.
Here's your meaning in life, and then, by the way, the tomatoes are hungry, and blah, blah, blah. But how, did that surprise her to receive?
Yes. She was shocked. You know, so then Peter was very excited because he was doing the garden, and he'd never done a garden before, so in sand especially. So he needed help. So he kept saying, look, go in and find out what, you know, what the lettuces need and what this needs. And so she would do that, and then she would also end up getting in touch with these greater beings of nature. And
was the pea the sort of the matriarch of the divas all along, or did they all sort of have equal?
No, it's like the, what she used the word devas instead of angels, because angels have so many connotations.
Religious, yes.
So it's back. So deva kind of means shining one in Sanskrit. And so what she was told is she was getting in contact with the overlighting archetype of each species.
Yes.
And so so that it's not one above another.
Yes.
Yeah. And so she would just, so they all, the devas were all so excited that somebody wanted to contact them and work with them in co-creating this garden, that they were lining up to talk to her, you know. So.
Well, that is so cool. Did she feel that they were conversing in English, or was it sort of a more of a, an intuitive thing that she kind of had to form the words herself? Or?
Right. So what she said is she would get these strong impressions. She wouldn't see anything or hear anything, but she would get these really strong impressions,
really?
And knowings, and then she would write them down.
Yes. Did she ever draw pictures or play music or anything to try to supplement the the linguistic expression.
No, other people drew pictures and all, but she did not.
Yes. And so around what year was that? Would that have been?
Well, if they 60s? Got there in 62, okay. Started probably, it was November of 62, so probably 63
yes.
Started.
And so then how did you first hear of Templeton yourself?
Well, I was just hitchhiking around Europe, and I wasn't looking for a spiritual community. I bought some ski boots in Chamonix, and I thought I was going to go back and ski, because that's what I'd done the previous couple winters. No, I wasn't looking for it, but I was at a Krishnamurti conference and met some people, and they had just spent 10 days at Findhorn. And so the vibration of the name intrigued me. And then they played some music that was from a group of musicians there, and it just touched my heart in a very deep way. So the description sounded really bizarre, this middle-aged English couple in a trailer park, you know.
Communicating with plants.
Yeah, I was fascinated. Then a couple other friends I'd met in Europe or other places showed up, and one of them had a VW van, and so we went up and visited.
Well, so it must have gone for a few years of just being like the gardens as they got it going and stuff, but then they eventually started creating the community, having other people come and having workshops and people come there and work, and that sort of all just kind of happened, kind of evolved.
Evolved. I mean, they were just trying to feed their family.
Yeah.
And then what happened was there was this miraculous growth in the sand. I mean, there was like 35-pound cabbages.
Yes, that's one of the legendary
broccoli plants that would feed them for a week. And
the hollyhocks.
Tall delphiniums and foxgloves and all, just phenomenal growth. And so somebody caught wind of it, and this educator named Sir George Trevelyan, and he mentioned it to some of his associates at the British Soil Association, and so they came up to test the soil, thinking, oh, it's just sand with a quarter inch of compost on it, it's going to be so deficient in so many things. And they did their tests, and it was deficient in nothing, and they couldn't believe it. And so Peter and Eileen were a little concerned about talking about working with the, you know, nature kingdom, because they thought they would be laughing stock. But
but the proof is in the pudding.
But eventually, this man Sir George did convince them to say what was going on, and then people just started showing up. You know.
And when you went, did you go just to visit for a little while and then came back later, or did you just kind of stay? You kind of gravitated there.
Staying, pretty much. Well, what I did is I visited for a couple weeks and got permission to join the community, and then my parents had sent me some money, and I was in my early 20s, and a winter coat, because it was October.
Yes.
And I had no coat.
And this is like 50-some degrees north, right?
This is the same latitude as Moscow.
Really?
And, So I decided I really better go meet these relatives in Norway and get the coat and the money. And then I came back and stayed there.
Well, and so how long did you end up living at Findhorn for?
7 years total. I went in two different time periods. I stayed 2.5 years the first time and then left thinking I was going to come right back. Got involved in some, actually living in a house with some other people that they had left as well.
Yes.
And stayed in the San Francisco Bay Area for a couple of years, and then ended up going back for another 4.5 years.
Yes. Now, at what point did they invite you, or how did you got involved in that, the very well-known book called The Magic of Findhorn, right? You did the photography for that.
Well, not The Magic of Findhorn.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was Paul Hawken.
Oh, okay.
And that didn't have any photographs in it.
Oh, what's the one you did?
The Findhorn Garden book.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was published by Harper and Row, and I did most of the photography for that. There was another guy, Will Elwell, who did some photography, and then, of course, the archives, some of the early pictures.
Yes, and when I looked through there, I was just, well, actually, there's that other book called Honoring the Earth.
To Honor the Earth.
To Honor the Earth. But that's the one where Dorothy McClain did the text and Thomas Berry wrote the introduction and you did the photography?
Yeah, it was actually, every now and then I just get this knowing that I need to do something.
Yes.
It's just like, I just know it. And that book is what I knew I needed to do.
Did that come out of while you were at Fentanyl too?
Well, the idea of it started out at Finhorn, but Dorothy had already left, and I was leaving soon. So basically, I got in touch with Dorothy, and she sounded like she'd like to be involved. And so basically, I wanted to communicate, you know, that it's possible to cooperate and even co-create with nature. And so that was of all of her hundreds of thousands of Deva messages, those were the ones that I wanted to focus on. And then what I did was I would find a message, and then I would just find one of my photographs that communicated to me the essence of what the message was, not necessarily the form of it, because it might have been from the Apple Deva, but it was a picture of something else.
Now, how did you meet Thomas Berry at Fentanyl?
I did not. I've never met.
Okay.
I never met Thomas Berry. So when Dorothy and I had done the book, and we had and Harper San Francisco was going to publish it, we were considering who to write. I think this was the foreword. I have to relook because I think Dorothy wrote the introduction or something.
Yes.
I asked a number of people, but by that point I was living at Esalen, and so I was in touch with a lot of kind of
big wigs
and people on the cutting edge of spirituality and physics and stuff. So, somebody suggested Thomas Berry, and so we both read some of what he'd written, and we went, oh, yeah.
Yes, I can understand.
Yeah, so I wrote him, and he was delighted, and so he wrote.
Oh, that is so cool. So now explain how, did you sort of graduate from Fentanyl to Esalen, or was there an overlap time, or did you learn of Esalen while you were at Fentanyl, or were you some of the same people that might have come both places or something? Or?
They had an exchange program.
For real?
One of the people at Fentanyl had set up, he visited Esalen and talked to them and said, you know, we're both spiritual communities dealing with the human potential movement, and we could learn a lot from each other, so why don't we have this exchange program where every year several people would come, we'd swap places, they'd stay in the other person's accommodation and, you know,
yes.
Swap. So
now, didn't you tell me that both Fentanyl and Esalen were practically founded at the exact same time?
Yeah, 2 days apart.
That's
in 1962.
That's so freaky.
Yeah.
They're like twins.
In a way.
Identical twins.
Not identical at all.
Maternal twins,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah. Don't push the analogy too far.
Exactly.
But yes. So, yeah, Esalen was November 15th, 1962, and Fentanyl was November 17th.
So now tell us about what is Esalen.
Well, Esalen is it's a workshop center. It is a community, but it's a community as a byproduct of offering the workshops to the public.
Yes, I'm located in Big Sur, California.
In Big Sur, California.
Doesn't that name, wasn't that the name of a Native American tribe from that area?
Yes, the Esalen Indians, spelt differently.
How did they spell it?
Esselen.
Okay.
So, that's how I ended up going to Esalen, because two photographers came from Esalen to work with me and the other person in the photography department at Fentanyl. And so we worked together, and they just said, oh, you have to come over to Esalen. So they basically arranged it for me to come the following year.
Had you been to Big Sur before?
I'd been through Big Sur, but I had never stopped at Esalen.
Yes.
You know, big sign, by reservation only.
Yes.
You know, didn't have the money to do anything like that.
Yes, that is so cool. So when you first went there, now there was a guy, I remember a guy, I never met him, but I think he was one of the founders, named Richard Price.
Yeah.
And and there were some other names, a guy named Michael Murphy,
mm-hmm.
Murphy.
No, Michael Murphy is Price.
But Michael Murphy is not the same guy that's made the chemtrail films, is it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No, he wrote a book called Golf in the Kingdom,
yeah.
And a couple other books.
But now I remember names. I did a couple of workshops at Esalen in the early, well, in 1978 with Dr. John Lilly and his wife Tony and Fritjof Capra. But I mean, it had already existed for a long time. But one of the biggest names I kept hearing was Alan Watts. And so he had been, I don't think he was still, he might have even passed away by the time I went there, but he was one of the more legendary people. But you would have met all kinds of, like, people that were, like, for example, Abraham Maslow?
No, I did not meet Maslow.
Okay.
That was before my
Okay, but you think he was one of the original sort of human potential psychologists,
yeah.
And then, but people like Stanislav Grof, and I mean a whole list of people, and then later on people like Rupert Sheldrake, and but who were some of your most influential contacts that you made there, or powerful, you know, what kind of effect, you know, like if Findhorn is founded on communicating with the plant kingdom and being with nature, how would Esalen's thing contrast with that? It's more about people. And our psychology and stuff.
Yeah, my experience is at Findhorn, everyone was, the focus was operating on the higher chakras, the heart chakra, speaking with awareness and all about, you know, creating harmony, learning to follow your own intuition, but seeing that you're part of a larger whole, and so that you're contributing your piece to the larger whole. So there was the emphasis on the well-being of both the individual and the greater whole. So when I got to Esalen, when I was there, it seemed that the focus was more on people learning how to claim their own power. It would have made more sense to go to Esalen first and then Findhorn, but
yes.
Yeah. So it was like I had to all of a sudden realize I'm in an environment where I had to put up some protections and,
yes,
and
be a little more competitive or defensive.
Yes, yes. So it was definitely a different experience, but there's a certain things in common is all the human potential and transpersonal workshops and the sense of community, because there were 125 people on various staff positions. So,
at Esalen?
Yeah, including work scholars and also there are people that would come for a program for a month or two or three.
How about at Findhorn? How many people there?
Well, when I got there, there was 120 people.
So about the same.
When I left, there was 350 people.
Really?
Yeah, and now it's Eileen's guidance, she would get guidance, and her guidance was that Findhorn would first be a family, then a community, then a village, and then a city of light.
And then is it going to become a planet?
No.
I'm just kidding.
So it's now the village stage.
Okay.
When I was there, it was the community stage,
yes.
So it has grown. There's, I don't know, probably well over 500 people involved on a regular basis with it.
Yes.
The community.
Well, let me ask you to reach a little bit, and could you conceive of the possibility of there being a third Findhorn, Esalen, yet another place that's maybe possibly being gestated right now that might, you know, I never thought this thought until this very second, but maybe there are other places that are kind of like that.
Oh, there are other places. In fact, when I was at Findhorn, there was somebody had this vision of seeing this triangle of light connecting Findhorn, Oroville in India, and Arcasante in
Arizona.
And so there was a kind of an exchange program between those three places, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one person that was at Findhorn for quite a while actually moved full-time to Oroville. She's still there.
Yes. Did you ever hear of a guy named Robert Lawler? He lived at Oroville for a long time. Now, how does the Ojai Foundation, how does it fit into this?
Well, actually, Meditation Mount has been staffed for a while by people who used to be at Findhorn when I was there. And then there's also there's other communities. There's one I've not been to, but it seems quite fascinating, called Damanhur in northern Italy.
I think I've heard of that. That's the one that's partially underground, isn't it?
Yes, and I really don't know that much about it, so yes. Please, yeah, I don't feel qualified to talk about it.
But that's okay, I was just sort of speculating here. Well, but back to the photography thing, what would you say that you were, you sort of did a lot of photography. That would be one of your main contributions at Findhorn and probably Esalen, but also on many other wavelengths of your own exploration and development and stuff like that. But what would you say then and now your basic philosophy of photography is? Like sharing the beauty and power of nature or you kind of touched on it a little before from your time with Minor.
Right, yeah. I mean, for me, it's kind of seeing the divinity in all of life and hopefully wanting to express that so that other people can see and experience that and to honor the earth and all who live upon it. A lot of people say that they feel that I capture a real spiritual dimension in my photography.
I feel that.
So that's very nice to hear.
Yes, well, through the choice of subject, but also your technical composition, and also your kind of special effects with your photos have a certain look to them, kind of a soft, kind of a mystical or an enchanted, like they're portals to a dimension, not just a flat photograph. Well, so now I'm going to ask you about this often misunderstood expression and I think I loosely said that Findhorn and Esalen were both sort of paragons of what a lot of people think of as the quote-unquote New Age movement. And I sort of use those words in quotation marks because you can describe, a lot of people kind of know kind of what you mean, but it's really kind of like the people that are for real in the world of spiritual development and understanding ancient esoteric psychologies and the cultures of other, people. A lot of people don't like that expression, but so tell us why.
Well, I think initially the impulse, New Age, was kind of it was definitely out of the mainstream, and it was exploring consciousness and other,
It described what Findhorn and Esalen were doing.
Right, and then what has happened is a lot of that awareness and consciousness has gone into the mainstream.
And it's become a commodity.
Right, and then it's become a commodity, and people are, trying to make money off of all these things. And so there's a lot of,
bastardization.
Trying to think of the word that, it's not necessarily ethical stuff.
Well, it's just a marketing, it's become a marketing category.
Yeah, and so those of us that were at Findhorn in the 70s and were, pretty involved there, a lot of us have stayed in touch, and we're just kind of a little, we don't use that term particularly at this point. I mean, for me, and for a lot of us, it's, we did all the workshops and learned all the stuff, and now the main job is to integrate it into everyday life and how you spend your time, what you're thinking, what you're doing, how you're doing it. Are you living with integrity and authenticity?
So what it's really all about all along, it's like being on determining what one's highest spiritual path is and finding it and being on it and maintaining it. And a lot of these different, sort of techniques and knowledge and wisdom systems and stuff are all sort of different means to achieve that, right?
You mean the marketing stuff?
No. I mean the real aspects of all all the stuff we've learned from India and from ancient China, and all the different cultures that a lot of the quote unquote New Age stuff seems to have drawn on. But the real purpose of it is because it all, if you take the stuff that's real, it really can help you formulate what your own highest path can be in this life.
Right, and I think for me, finding what truly resonates, that speaks truth to me, and following that, which may not be somebody else's path.
Exactly.
But so for me, I've kind of moved a little more away from ceremony and ritual, because I realized for me, being spontaneous in the moment and just connecting with nature or, you know, other beings directly just seems more kind of my style.
Yes.
Rather than to formalize it into some ritual where I go and certain things have to be done in exactly
and charge
a certain
people
way.
Like, people are paying $1,000 to come and see you talk, and then they're going to buy your book and your DVD. But, you know, we have to say that there is a place for marketing, because otherwise, if you've got a beautiful book of photographs or, you know, a DVD of music or something like that, you've got to get it out there to people, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I was just talking about that personally, I've kind of moved away from the more formal ceremony aspect that a lot of people are really into.
Yes.
Because and I certainly respect it, but for me, I realized it's not kind of how I operate in the world.
Yes.
And so I'm kind of more, I like to say, my church's nature, you know.
We're in it right now. We're in church.
Absolutely.
What is so beautiful? Well, so let's get on to my favorite beings on this whole planet, the whales and dolphins. Mm. And so, did they find you?
Well, interesting.
Do you remember when you ever very first saw any or thought of them, or?
Well, you know, I was one of those people that never actually watched Flipper, so I didn't.
You never saw Flipper.
I never saw. I think, I don't know whether I was at Findhorn at the time or I didn't have a TV, whatever. But I was, in 1990, I was living in Northern California, and I was diagnosed with kidney cancer. And so it was kind of a shock. I said, oh, well, it's 50-50 chance of survival. So I did a meditation that's a really powerful meditation. If I had 6 months to live, what would I need to do to feel complete in this life? And what I got, the first thing that came in, like totally out of the blue, was swim with dolphins. And so I was facing major surgery, this book deadline for To Honor the Earth. And I didn't really have any money, so I just thought, okay, well, next year when I, you know, I'll investigate this, because I thought the only place you could swim with dolphins was captive dolphins in the Florida Keys. So then a friend who lived in Hawaii offered to set up a book tour and workshops for Dorothy and I for To Honor the Earth. And so we were over in Oahu, and someone came over to where we were staying and said, oh, well, if you're going to the Big Island, you need to look up Joan Ocean. She swims with wild dolphins and is in telepathic contact with them. So Dorothy and I both, you know, came to attention, got her phone number, and then called her when we got here. And so she took us out. Well, actually, Dorothy had cut her eye right above on the car door, so she couldn't wear a mask and go in the water. But I went out and swam with the dolphins, and that kind of changed my life.
Now, tell us about what was that like?
Well,
is that at Two-Step?
No, it was Kealakekua Bay.
Okay.
But those particular experiences didn't change my life, although I felt something. But I knew I needed to return and swim with them more. And it was when I came back. After the book was out, the To Honor the Earth, you know, I don't know whether after a big project or a big thing where you're just totally occupied with something, and then after it's all over, sometimes you kind of sink into a bit of a depression. And so I was feeling really down. And I was feeling that all my life force was streaming out my fingertips, and I couldn't get it back. And then after swimming with the dolphins the second time when I went, I noticed they got me back in touch with my joy and my juice. And so that was a real transformation. And I do believe they were helpful in my greater healing. I cannot say, oh, they cured me of cancer, because I had surgery and I went on a 5-year immunology program and I started swimming with the dolphins. So I think it was all of it, you know, but they certainly got me back in touch with my joy and my juice for living.
Yes. Did they have anything to do with your decision to move here to the Big Island?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So that's one of the reasons I moved here. Another was I love warm tropical waters and the climate and the vegetation and a wonderful community of people here that I'd met over the 10 years that I would come and visit. And then I bought a place and, you know, then slowly got here full time.
Yes. You're so cool. Well, so last night I was able to watch your beautiful little film called A Whale Journey.
Yeah, Whale Journey.
Whale Journey, and it was really cool. So, but tell us about that. How did you get the idea for that? Because it was made in 2014, and so tell us, who are the whales and dolphins to you? And well, did they give you the idea to do this film?
Well, I, you know, being a photographer, I had all this footage. I, like, when I'm in the water with the whales and dolphins, I do a lot of video and also stills. And so I had all this material, and I'd been working on a dolphin DVD, which is still 99% complete. I'm just waiting for this permission for this one music score. But,
What will it be? Is it just underwater footage of dolphins?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Will it have talking?
I don't know. See, that's the part. With the whale journey, I used some quotes from basically scientists.
Yes.
Because I wanted it to be credible. But at the same time, I wanted the whole experience to be a meditation and a way to go deeper into connecting with the whales. And so I had some friends who are musicians compose an original score for it, and then just using quotes so that it wouldn't be somebody talking over the whole experience.
Like David Attenborough.
Well, I mean, he does wonderful work,
no,
but I wanted a different experience.
To me, it's so, the whales and dolphins, I mean, you know, we could talk about this for hours, but they communicate in many different ways at extremely high levels of complexity and sophistication, but to me, it's improper to say that they use language, unless you want to define language very broadly as a system of communication. You know, so, but I think that a lot of times, so much of human behavior is rooted in talking. Please forgive me for talking right now. But you see what I'm saying? I think a lot of the, my approach to the whales and dolphins is to listen to their sounds.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been a lot of scientific research, more so lately, that they're discovering that they have a very sophisticated language and communication system, much more sophisticated than ours, and it's going at a speed that is a lot faster than ours, too, plus they have
multiple channels simultaneously.
Yeah, but also if they slow it down,
yes,
then they start seeing more things up. And no, then they also have their sonar, which is also communication. So,
didn't you tell me that you got to meet Dr. Roger Payton one time?
Oh, well, a long time ago, I went to a conference that he spoke at. So
okay.
I don't know. I was able to meet Sean Burley a number of times, both at Esalen and also here.
Yes, and what did you think about him?
Well, it was interesting because we were both sitting in front of John Ocean's house, and I was reading his book. And he was
Which
sitting
one?
There. Oh, I think it was the first one, Man and Dolphin, or
okay,
whatever, which there's a new edition of, which I got from his son, actually.
Philip Bailey?
Yeah, I think that's his name. So, got another whole section to it.
What did you talk with Marie about? He probably liked you because you were an attractive blonde woman.
No, we didn't actually talk a lot. It was more just sharing space, but I, yeah.
Did you find that he was kind of, he had kind of a prickly vibe?
Well, very private vibe.
Yes.
Very private vibe. So I, I'm not the type of person to barge into people's spaces.
Well, when I met him, we were doing workshops at Esalen, but even when he was doing the workshop, he still seemed like it was kind of a struggle for him to come back down into his body. But after reading his, he gave me a copy of his autobiography called The Scientist, which talked about all his experiences with ketamine. And I think this was still when he was still doing that.
Oh, yeah.
And you could really tell. I mean, I see all this in hindsight, but yeah, he was I still consider him to be one of my very most important teachers.
Mm.
But, and so you're going to have a new film about the dolphins.
Well, if I finish it, I mean, I have so much excellent footage of dolphins. So I really would like to finish it. Just that, current projects and things that need attention arise constantly. So it's a matter of priorities.
Yes.
Yeah.
So who are some of your very favorite minds among humans that have been your most influential people over your life and the years and decades, and not necessarily from Fintown or Esalen, but anywhere, this planet or any planet?
Well, I think that first one was Minor White that I mentioned before, because he opened my eyes to a way of seeing and a way of going beyond just seeing in photography. And then I would say Ed Tinhorn, Peter and Eileen Patty, and Dorothy McLean, obviously, and another man called R. Ogilvy Crombie, we called him Rock, who was also very involved with the nature spirits. And then I would say at Esalen, Joseph Campbell. I got to know him pretty
well.
Did you?
The legendary mythology guy.
Yes.
For real.
In fact, he says I took the best photographs of him that were taken.
So tell, what was he like?
He was great. I mean, he would, he would give these workshops at Esalen, but then he was quite engaging to speak to. And he had his 80th birthday there. And
really?
So it was so funny. I have these pictures of him surrounded by all these women and all these bottles of whiskey on the table. Let's see.
Did he have any certain favorite sort of mythological themes that he specifically liked to talk about, or certain insights into?
Well, Bill Moyers did a wonderful series called The Power of Myth with Joseph Campbell, and it was, I thought he did just such an excellent job. But I think one of the ones is the Holy Grail myth, where...
Monty Python?
No. No, where each knight went into the forest alone where there wasn't already an established path. And that we each have our own journeys, and it's not about following in the footsteps of somebody else. It's finding our own way and finding out, what that Grail experience means to us,
Yes. Well, now, may I ask you something? This may or may not be the best place to, but with respect to Joseph Campbell, did he ever talk about his beliefs about what our society, we call it death, but I don't really think that's the best word. What the ancient Egyptians called it, coming forth by day, which to them was an awakening. But did he ever talk about that in his writings or, because it's such a profound aspect of living.
I don't remember.
You mentioned that you also really liked Paramahansa Yogananda. And to me, I read his book, Autobiography of a Yogi, many, many, many years ago, but I could hardly put it down. It was such a good book. And when you just look at that picture of him and the light in his eyes, and to me, I mean, this is just based on my limited knowledge, but to me, he's the most real of any of the quote-unquote gurus or whatever you want to call them that have come into the West from India. But so now tell us about how you came onto his work and how his work has affected you.
Well, I was, I'd been living in Aspen and being kind of a ski bum, skiing by day and, having a waitress job at night. And And then some people went over to Maui, and so I went over for the summer, and I met this guy who loaned me this book, Autobiography of a Yogi, and it was like my world just went completely upside down, because I was kind of on this path of thinking that the purpose of life is seek pleasure, avoid pain. And then it was like this whole other dimension came up. And also right before I read the book, someone had given me a triple dose of mescaline, and it was kind of like the intensity of an acid trip. And it was like, so between that experience and reading the book, my whole vision of reality was upended. So,
luckily it wasn't Stephen King. But that's so cool. That would have been a major turning point.
Yeah. So that was a huge turning point. And then I started re-examining my life, and that's when I decided to go back to school and get my degree in photography.
Yeah.
And, you know, a number of things. And then I ended up at Vintorn, which furthered, you know, my spiritual path.
Well, I can't think of a better two-way door opener into the spirituality of photography and communicating with plants and self-actualization than mescaline crossed with Paramahansa Yogananda. This could be a new paradigm of transformation.
Yeah. So anyway, it was for me.
That's very interesting.
And then I was thinking, who else has had a real influence on me and my path in life? And you know, Joan Ocean has. I mean, she...
Well, she's a friend, too, isn't she?
She's a friend, but, you know, I've known her since 1991. And I have never seen her say a bad word about anybody. She always seeks and accentuates the positive in every situation. And I just think she has so much integrity. I don't share the same types of experiences she has with other dimensions, but I totally believe just knowing her and how integral she is.
Well, she does have.
I totally believe that is her experience. So
yes, well, when I met her, when you took me up to her house a few weeks ago, and I saw her eyes, the first thing I said to her was, like, you got amazing looking eyes. They reminded me of a dolphin's eyes. and then she kind of like looked away. But you have had connections with Pleiadians, but in a more indirect way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and nothing is very concrete in all those experiences. They're just very subtle whispers, and I really. Not enough to really talk about. I just know that when I look up in the sky in the winter, I always feel more reassured when I connect with the Pleiades.
Absolutely. Well, and they're in the sky in the evening now.
Yeah.
My own thing, I think a lot of this, the UFO cult people and all that kind of stuff, I mean, everybody is entitled to their own reality. And even if other people are paying thousands of dollars to come and, you know, like, hope they get abducted, you know, or whatever it is that they're doing, that's their choice, you know, and it's all this game that people can play. But to me, I think that there's life and consciousness and intelligence permeating every dimension of the universe, but we tend to project our own anthropomorphic patterns and structures onto it all. And I go, like, but look, why on earth is a being from another planet going to look like us, only with, like, mutated grooves on our face, you know, like in Star Trek? Or that, I mean, why would it even be visible? You know, so I go, like, it's like, you know, I go, like, you know, show me an alien that I can shake hands with, and then I'll believe it. But I certainly honor everyone's feelings and everyone's path. And like we were talking about before, the whales and dolphins are truly an extraterrestrial intelligence. Extraterrestrial meaning land, not planet Earth, but they're, you know, but who knows where they actually may have come from.
That's,
you know,
true.
But it's very, you know, like but we're in space right now. We don't actually have to go to space. We're already there.
Yes, and we're hurtling along at a breathtaking speed. I was just reading some article about how fast our galaxy is moving, how fast our planet's moving. You know, it's just like we're whizzing through space.
Well, and we don't even know which way we're going, because there's no solid reference frame. Did I tell you that I've been reading this book called A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson?
Right.
You would love that book.
I know.
If you ever had time to read.
I do have time to read. I do read.
I read it before I go to bed every night.
Yes. Bill Bryson is a fantastic writer, and I really want to read this book.
Yes. Well, now, who was the third person?
Okay, so the third person current in my life is one of my teachers in Maui. I kind of became part of the Sufi community.
Oh, because, for real?
For me, it's the closest thing to what Findhorn was like. It's a service, the path with the heart, and of service. And focusing on celebrating life and living in harmony and love and joy. And so her name is Leila. And
L-A-L-A?
No, it's L-E-I-L-A.
Leila, but Leila.
Leila is how she pronounces it. And her husband, Bodhi. The two of them are just phenomenal.
Like the Bodhi tree.
Yeah. And so they're so down to earth, and they set just a real example of more of what I aspire to be in my own life.
Yes. That is so cool. Well, have you heard of a guy named Gurdjieff?
Oh, yeah.
He relates with the Sufis, and I have a friend of mine is kind of a Gurdjieff scholar in Australia, but that relates to the Sufi path, doesn't it?
Well, I was in a Gurdjieff group for about 3 years when I lived on the East Coast, and I gained a lot out of it. It was right before I went to Findhorn, and what I, for me personally, I learned a lot, but I didn't find the heart. It wasn't a path with the heart, especially Ouspensky.
Yes, he was very...
Gurdjieff, I think I would have... think he probably had the heart, but... when I got to Findhorn, I realized, this is more resonant with my path and my values and... how I want to live and be.
Yes.
You know, it has to have the heart.
Well, could you say, in a rough generalization, that Findhorn is more yin and Esalen was more yang? I mean, not totally, but...
I think there's more...
The two cores of the
generalization. Higher chakras and lower chakras.
Ah, okay.
You know, in terms of where my experience of the focus was.
Yes.
You know, at Esalen, people were more, at that time, I don't know now, focused on what was good for them personally and not so much about anybody else.
Yes.
You know, like there was one job position, it was pretty cutthroat to try and get it, or, you know. Learning to express your feelings without regard to how it would be received by the other person. And
yes.
So it was, when I first got there, it was pretty shocking to me because at Findhorn you would never, like...
Well, I call it, there's an expression, looking out for number one.
Yeah, yeah. Now, obviously, there was a lot of great people there, and I have a lot of friends that I made there. So I'm not talking about everybody, but just...
Yes.
There was this undercurrent of that energy there.
That each person is kind of a budding celebrity.
Pardon?
Each person's a budding celebrity.
Well, I don't know about that.
I'm just kidding.
But I think it's very important to go through the stage of learning to, first of all, recognize what your truth is and be willing to stand up for yourself and express it.
Yes.
I'm not saying that, you know, there's anything wrong with that. It's just... how to do that so that you're not blasting people around you.
Yes.
You know, there's a way to,
yes,
to stand up for yourself and still be considerate.
Yes, and diplomatic.
Diplomatic, that's a better word.
Yes. Well, now, let me ask you this. We're probably getting close to the end of our of our hour. If this broadcast was going to go out into the mobile phone and television of not only every person on this planet, but every television screen and mobile phone and internet connection in the whole galaxy.
Oh,
for the next minute, what would you say? Well, you don't have to speak. You could dance or sing or make funny faces or anything.
I guess I would say what I attempt to do is vibrate at the highest frequency I can in as many moments as that I can. So it's not to put any kind of task on anybody else. I love the Dalai Lama, you know, one of his quotes that says, "My religion is kindness." And so I would just say, coming from love and kindness and respect is...
Yes.
And caring for all life.
Well, I think that you, the Maori of New Zealand, have a beautiful word called kaitiaki. It's K-A-I-T-I-A-K-I. Kaitiaki, it means a spiritual guardian. And I think that you're truly a kaitiaki of Ohana Moana and of what the Lakota would call Mitikaye Oyasin, all of our relations, our family of life. Mm-hmm. And Kathy, I really want to thank you for everything. It's been so lovely hanging out with you, and thank you for this time. And maybe we can do another interview sometime. But just in the last 30 seconds, how can someone order some of your beautiful coffee mugs?
Oh, these color.
Tell us your website.
www.kathleentcarr.com. I don't have the mugs on the website yet.
But they will be. But they're really cool. When you heat them up, the image appears, and then when it cools down, they disappear. But yeah, you've got some beautiful photography, and people can order your prints and DVDs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Look, thank you. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Thank you, Kathy.
Oh, thank you.
There was another sort of legendary maverick of the mind that lived here on the Big Island named Terence McKenna, who I sort of likened to be kind of like a psychedelic guru, kind of like Timothy Leary of the Next Generation. And he was big on DMT, but he had a lot of, you know, he was quite a very insightful mind and a very, you know, a scientifically rigorous intellect. But yesterday I was hanging out with Douglas Webster, who we know, and he said he thought that Terence McKenna, when he lived here, he lived up on the mountain, and he had an ultra-fast broadband internet connection that nobody else had, that he got through some kind of connections he had with the military or something like that. And I was talking about how, you know, he died of brain cancer, but he wasn't that old. And Douglas reckoned that they targeted him because of the influence that he had, and that he was actually quite political, which I never would have guessed. I never knew. But so you actually knew him. What kind of person was he in terms of how you knew him?
Well, I knew him first in California because he would come to Esalen a lot and he'd teach workshops, and I was one of my jobs was to audio record speakers and workshops.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always audio recording his workshops. And I would love it because whether I agreed with what he was saying or not, I just loved that he would stretch my mind and my way of thinking into realms that I would never have traveled on my own. And
like a helium balloon.
Well, I don't know, but one of his quotes that he would say, which, and I can't remember who originally said this quote, but he would quote them, and it was like, "The universe is not only stranger than we suppose, it's stranger than we can suppose."
Well, I can tell you who originally said that.
Oh, good.
J.B.S. Haldane.
Yeah.
But that's good. That's a very good one.
And so that's what Terence did for me. And the quality of his voice and the way he would talk would be so mesmerizing. So because I recorded so many workshops, I have a gazillion cassette tapes of him talking, and pretty far out.